or two for the Orange Menace. If Donnie thought he won the debate, he won't accept an election loss. Okay, enough worry. I worry we won't get enough rain at the right time for there to be chanterelles. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You are listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, September 18th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael, Doug McVeigh, and Reed Johnson. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Kathleen Shannon, Edwin J. Vieira, Catherine Carley, Antonia Gonzalez, and Mike Moen. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings.
And I'm Reed Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our great members. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, so now is a great time to join. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. We'll be talking about the conditions that homeless Oregonians are facing in Grants Pass.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm speaking with Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, about his new article. It's called Unconscionably Bad Circumstances at Grants Pass Homeless Sites. Cities blame state law for hindering efforts on homelessness, but as conditions deteriorate, Governor Kotek stays quiet about homeless Oregonians' rights. Welcome to the show, Jeremiah.
Hi, Althea. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for taking the time to talk with us about this. Before we get into your most recent piece on Grants Pass, let's start with some background here. Prior to August, what has been the story of homelessness in Grants Pass?
Listeners will remember that Grants Pass was at the center of a court case that ended up at the Supreme Court after the city was sued in 2018. Attorneys had said that, you know, Grants Pass had made it completely impossible for anyone to live in Grants Pass without being punished with fines or jail time. The city won that case, which essentially overturned the Ninth Circuit Court, the Grants Pass v. Johnson decision, and the Martin v. Boise decision, which were interrelated decisions by the Ninth Circuit. And it essentially sent it back. There's a state law standing in the way of fully punishing, doing what California and some other states across the United States have done, which is just enforced with criminal and civil punishments, simply basically for being homeless. So there's a state law. It stands in the way. Probably more to come on that in the future. But yeah, they won the case, and essentially they are allowed to. It is constitutional, the Supreme Court said, for them to punish homeless residents.
So then moving into your most recent visit to Grants Pass, what did you observe in these new shelter sites that they've been working on?
Yeah, I was curious about this, like what Grants Pass is doing in light of that decision, but also because of that state law and what kind of the implications are if that law ends up being challenged. And if that law goes away, any city in Oregon, you know, could potentially do what Grants Pass is doing. So while I was there, you know, a few weeks ago in August, the city designated a few new homeless sites, and they opened those just about 10 days before I went down to visit Grants Pass. I visited during a heat wave. It was 104 one day, and it was well over 100 for the other 3 days. And they basically argue that they don't have to provide anything except for a place to stay due to the state law. So they put people out on this concrete and gravel lot with no shade. They're not allowed to, the city provided no shade. People are not allowed to put tarps up, like on the fence, over their tents, to try to shade themselves. And, you know, there's just a lot of people out there who have really now nowhere to go. They can't stay in parks under trees. They're very familiar with the people in the community, and a lot of people in the community there have really been, you know, a little bit threatening toward homeless residents in Grants Pass. So people really feel stuck there. They're under 24-hour surveillance. The city spent $29,000 on a surveillance tower that police can view at any time, and they are doing that. And basically any humanitarian aid is left to organizations down there, nonprofit organizations. Mint is one of the ones that has really stepped up over the last few years in parks and then now in these sites. But, you know, that's like 9 volunteers, and they're just running around trying to bring water to people in the middle of a heat wave.
Well, speaking of this heat wave, multiple homeless residents with disabilities have been in serious danger because of these conditions you've described. Can you tell our listeners what happened to them?
Yeah, the first day that I showed up, you know, I talked to a woman who's very kind, and she was sitting with a friend right next to a fence, just in this little patch of shade that the fence provided. And she told me that she had just been basically released from a hospital, got into a hotel to recover for 2 days. But once the 2 days was up, the only place she had to go was the site at J Street there. So she was just out in the heat immediately following that, without much time to recover. You know, I talked to this guy, Chad Patty. He's 43 years old. He has multiple diagnoses, and he was in the emergency room just prior to the city opening these sites. And he was released from the emergency room. They discharged him. He went to the parks. He was having severe gastrointestinal issues. From the parks, police came just a day or so later, told him he had 20 minutes to leave. Sent him to the park where he passed out. He was still having these gastrointestinal issues because obviously he had not had enough time to recover. And he was severely dehydrated, passed out. He couldn't wheel his wheelchair to the outhouses, and he had to use a plastic bag in his tent as a restroom because he really didn't have a way to get around. This gravel is really thick, and so people with mobility devices really can't get around on the ground. So he was, you know, the first person I talked to was Dr. Bruce Murray. He works for Mint, and he told me that they had basically saved his life. He was really not doing well when they saw him.
So with that in mind, I guess, with that being something that is happening, where does Governor Tina Kotek land on this issue? The state law that requires city ordinances on homelessness to be objectively reasonable was something she passed when she was in charge at the state legislature.
Yeah, I thought that if anybody, you know, would really make a strong statement, it might be her. You know, she is the co-sponsor of this. She was Speaker of the House in 2021 when the House passed this bill. She sort of didn't want to get into necessarily how enforcement of that might work, and more just kind of repeated essentially what the law says, you know, saying that the law requires a city choosing to regulate survival activities must be reasonable. And she added something that is important. It must also take into account the resources available to houseless individuals and the impact of the city's regulations on people experiencing homelessness. That's something that Grants Pass kind of is not doing, because the city really doesn't have resources. They don't have a shelter. So people really are left out there without these resources unless a nonprofit is providing it to them. So Kotek, you know, didn't really make any strong indications that she was, directly explained kind of what I saw when I went there, and asked if she thought it was objectively reasonable. She didn't reply to that. And then I asked if she had been in touch with the Oregon Department of Justice about this, and that she also didn't discuss. I did talk to somebody at the Department of Justice who said that Kotek's office had not been in touch with her about this.
What are the material conditions at these sites now, and how much of what is there is from the city versus other sources?
The city provided 4 outhouses at the J Street site and 4 hand washing stations. And then there's one on A Street. It's directly across from City Hall and the police station. And they provided 2 outhouses and 2 hand washing stations there. That's it. And a 24-hour surveillance tower. They will not provide water. That's something that has been discussed and something that they're not getting into. Again, this is sort of they just do not want. They don't believe that they need to provide anything under the state law except for another place for people to go. So really, it's left to these volunteers to drop off water. They have a bunch of water that's been delivered, but not at the site. They go out every day because one of the issues is, well, to correct myself, the city also provided 1 dumpster, which was overflowing. And something that was of concern to the council, so potentially providing another one at some point. But that's a concern of the council. They don't want people delivering big piles of things there because they're afraid it's going to lead to trash buildup. So these organizations, Mint in particular, are explicitly, quote-unquote, allowed to deliver this stuff, but they really do it just throughout the day. They don't drop it off and then go take care of other things.
Well, talking about these dangerous conditions, especially for some of these homeless residents with disabilities, how has Grants Pass City Council responded since this heat wave happened?
Basically, by September 11th, they came and gave people 72-hour eviction notices from those sites. You might remember from a previous conversation that people are required to move. Once a week, people will get 72-hour eviction notices where they need to move to the other site and vice versa. So they did that by September 11th. They were ticketing people, handing out these eviction notices. And then just by Monday, people were getting $50 tickets. The doctor, Bruce Murray at Mint, has been giving disabled people letters saying, you know, that they are medically vulnerable and they cannot move, but officers are not honoring those doctor's notes and are still telling people that they need to go. So basically it's just kind of a place, you know, the rules align. The chief, Warren Hensman there, police chief, wanted to do an emergency, declare an emergency and then pass this ordinance while I was in town actually on September 4th. That made these designated sites have identical rules as the city parks. So people are now forced to move under threat of criminal trespass from site to site, even though these are the designated places for them to go.
For this article, you also spoke with a police officer who is charged with enforcing the ordinance, and you write that he has quite a bit of discretion.
The city council is a little bit hesitant to honor these doctor's notes that saying people cannot move and get kind of involved in policy making that might make this more objectively reasonable. And so they have left some things a little less explicit and said officer discretion, you know, but and kind of leaving that to officer discretion. Again, that discretion, just to kind of be clear, as I walked around with his officer or sergeant, Josh Ninneman is his name. I walked around the site with him when I was down there, and he was friendly with people, kind of explaining to people, you know, trying to lay their anxieties about whether or not their space was larger than 8 by 8 feet, whether they had, you know, enough space between their tents. They're supposed to have 6 feet. And he was generally warm and conversational and educational, you know, with them. And then at one point he said, you know, that he thought some of the doctors and, you know, more like advocates for the homeless were maybe exaggerating a little bit. because he didn't see all that many mobility devices, wheelchairs and stuff at the site. And so he said, you know, I don't see all that many people who couldn't actually move due to a disability. So that discretion, you know, there's a lot to talk about in there about people with invisible disabilities. And again, that's not really a police officer's choice to, you know, make. That's something that a medical professional would say, which is why people have doctor's notes.
Well, as you're alluding to, there could be an ADA violation in this too. How does that come in?
I mean, I think that, you know, to some extent, it's clear that the ADA has these specific requirements for governments to prohibit discrimination against people with disabilities. It says, Title II says, you know, state and local governments must make reasonable modifications to policies, practices, and procedures where needed to make sure that a person with a disability can access the state and local government's programs, services, or activities. And if the city is going to create this site and tell people that they have to go there, you know, that is somewhere between a program, service, or activity. And if those accommodations, if there aren't accommodations made, you know, it could be legally like maybe these people don't have to move, or the site itself needs to, you know, be made a little bit more readily available for people with disabilities. I'm not sure what the fix there is exactly, but it certainly seems like a pretty explicit violation of that.
I'm also curious, what is the relationship between Grants Pass and Josephine County here? You note in the article, more homeless residents have decided to move out to the woods, some of which is owned by the county, since these restrictions came into place.
Yeah, I went out actually one day to do some, to follow along with Jessica Miller from Mint, who's delivering some sandwiches made by St. Vincent de Paul out to this place called Devil's Slide. And some people have moved out there and made some encampments. It's like 3 miles out on the railroad tracks. People have been living out there for years and have honestly built some pretty incredible survivalist encampments out there. But, you know, Josephine County declined to receive funding from the state when Governor Kotek declared issued this executive order, 2302. That sent millions of dollars for Portland listeners. That is money that helped pay for, you know, Ted Wheeler's task sites changed a lot from being these tent sites, you know, where they were going to have no services guarded by the National Guard. And then she created all of these other things that came with that money to kind of, you know, bolster, you know, the kind of experience that people would have there. So now they have these hardened services, the pods, that kind of thing. Josephine County declined that funding. And when Grants Pass wrote a letter to the governor saying, we actually, as the largest city in Josephine County, we actually need this funding to help with our homelessness crisis, Josephine County declined to route that to the governor as would have been required. So there is this kind of tension here between the county just saying, they said their response was, you know, we don't want to get into the shelter business. Grants Pass doesn't either. You know, the council president, Vanessa J, told me she's not sure this council would accept that funding at this point either. But it is interesting to think about millions of dollars that could help to go to some of the temporary solutions. Again, not affordable housing, but some of the temporary solutions is something that Josephine County and Grants Pass are kind of squabbling over.
Where do you see things going from here, or what questions are still unanswered in this story?
I think the main question is who is going to step in and say something about it. I think sort of objectively, you know, when you kind of list, you know, the things that are happening, just a bare plot of land, people can't go anywhere. They're evicted from the exact place they were told they have to go to every single week, destabilized every week. People with disabilities cannot get around on gravel. There's no water in a heat wave. Not to mention there's going to be, you know, it's going to be winter soon. So like, what's going to happen at that point? When you list those off, it starts to become somewhat clear that it's objectively unreasonable. The question is who's going to step in, if not the governor, the attorney general's office, you know, hasn't said anything about it exactly, or in the sense that they have not said that they would step in. And so it may be just something like a lawsuit, a class action lawsuit or something could happen in the future. I don't know. It just, who knows? You know, and then on the other side of it is, this is kind of how, thanks to the Supreme Court's decision, like, this is how cities, states, entire regions and our nation are choosing to deal with homelessness.
If our listeners are interested in learning more, what's the best way for them to do that?
The best way to get Street Roots is to buy a copy from a vendor. They accept cash and Venmo and tips, and you can also find us at streetroots.org.
Do you have any final thoughts?
I guess the only thing is that this is really important in the context of the state. It's, you know, I know there's like Portland Station, Street Roots is a Portland newspaper. Why am I going to Grants Pass? And of course, it's the Supreme Court's decision. But cities, you know, liberal, democratic, you know, democratic elected officials are calling for that law to be repealed, which is the only thing even remotely standing in the way of people doing this everywhere.
Well, Jeremiah, thank you so much for taking the time to talk through this with us.
Althea, thanks for having me.
That was Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, speaking with me about his latest article. It's called "Unconscionably Bad Circumstances at Grants Pass Homeless Sites. Cities blame state law for hindering efforts on homelessness, but as conditions deteriorate, Governor Kotek stays quiet about homeless Oregonians' rights." More information is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
A new article entitled "Drug Decriminalization, Fentanyl, and Fatal Overdoses in Oregon" was published September 5th in the American Medical Association's journal JAMA Network Open. It shows that the recent rise in overdose deaths in Oregon was not related to the decriminalization of possession of some drugs, but rather to the introduction of fentanyl to the drug market. To learn more, I spoke with the lead author, Michael Zurab, PhD.
My name is Michael Zurab. I'm a data scientist in New York City. I also am a consultant at Rhode Island Hospital doing research related to substance use epidemiology.
I've asked you on to talk about a new article of which your lead author, entitled "Drug Decriminalization, Fentanyl, and Fatal Overdoses in Oregon," which was published September 5th in the journal JAMA Network Open. Let's start from the top. What led you to look at the relationship between criminalization of people who use drugs and deaths due to a toxic, unregulated drug supply and drug overdose?
Yeah, I guess there's like a broad answer and a specific answer. The broad answer is that, as we all know, there's a big overdose crisis in the United States, and the sort of primary policy regime has been criminalization in the United States for many decades. And so, you know, when states experiment with new things, new public policies, that's something I'm interested in as a researcher. In general, I think the specific catalyst is prior work that's been done on this exact topic. So, as listeners may know, you know, there have been a couple of prior studies that took a look at Measure 110 and its effects on overdose. And one thing that my co-authors and I noticed is that they didn't really systematically account for the spread of fentanyl to Oregon. So fentanyl, you know, first emerged in the eastern United States drug markets many years ago, around 2014. And as we show in the paper, it's sort of spread west gradually. Interestingly, in Canada, the reverse dynamic is true. It started in the west and spread east, but in the US, east to west. And, you know, it hit the West Coast around the same time as Measure 110. And we know, like, from my prior work, from a lot of other work on this topic, that the thing that's driving, you know, the primary driver of year-to-year variation in overdose death rates between states is fentanyl, when the opioid market transitions from being primarily heroin-based to primarily fentanyl-based. And so we were surprised to learn that, you know, these prior studies, one of them in particular, basically never, you know, does not in any meaningful way account for this transition in drug supply, and simply assumes that the overdose death changes that occurred in Oregon in 2021 were due to Measure 110, kind of overlooking this really important confounding variable. And we thought it was important to take a hard look at this problem, you know, while appropriately accounting for the role of fentanyl.
So what did you find?
Well, the paper does a few things. First, like I said, we traced the spread of fentanyl across the United States from east to west. We show that Measure 110, which took effect at the beginning of 2021, pretty much coincides with fentanyl saturating the drug supply in Oregon. So we do a statistical analysis of drug seizures and show that fentanyl really spiked around that same time. That's the sort of first thing. Measure 110 occurs, in some ways, quite unfortunately, at the same time that this transition in drug markets happened. That's the first thing we show. And the second thing we show, although I don't think this is a particularly surprising thing, is just that, like I mentioned, if you look at, if you try to model changes in overdose death rates between states over time, the primary, you can explain most of the variation with a measure of fentanyl exposure in recent years. I mean, this is really the primary driver of overdose death rates. The changes in overdose death rates between places on a short-term timeline. And so we sort of show that statistically. There's some visualizations in the paper to this effect. So I would say that's the second thing we find. We sort of replicate previous findings that show that overdose death rates increased in Oregon after Measure 110. And then we show that if you, appropriately adjust for this change in drug supply, the transition from predominantly heroin to predominantly fentanyl, this effect goes away. And instead of finding, having a statistical model that finds a positive association between Measure 110 taking effect and overdose death rates, we find, a result that is consistent with there being no effect. And so in the first 2 years after Measure 110 took effect, our finding is that, our best guess, and there's some uncertainty about this, for sure, there's really not a lot of statistical power for, single state interventions and measuring their effects, but our estimate, the result is consistent with there being no effect on overdose death rates, and we can kind of rule out large changes in either direction. And then finally, there's sort of a supplementary analysis where we look at Washington State, which, as you may know, Washington State briefly, because of a court case decision, had a few months where drugs were possession of small amounts of drugs was decriminalized, and then they recriminalized drugs, and we sort of show that despite this much different policy trajectory from Oregon, overdose death rates trended in very much the same way. And so overdose death rates were increasing in Oregon, in Washington, around the time of the Blake decision that decriminalized drugs, and they continued increasing, and in fact increased mortality rates even accelerated in their increase after recriminalization. And we, to be clear, I don't think that's because of decriminalization and recriminalization. I really just think it's because of fentanyl. When you account for that, that's really what's explaining these big changes in overdose death rates on a short-term timeline.
Normally, I ask about the policy implications of your research, and I want to ask about that. But before I do, I want to ask you, what are the implications of your research for people who use drugs?
I mean, I don't think this is a particularly new insight for people who use drugs, but I think this really just underscores the importance of supply and how unpredictable and, toxic drug supply is a huge risk factor. And so to the extent that you have access to the ability to monitor drugs for contaminants, you should absolutely take advantage of that, because this is really what's killing people. I mean, one really interesting phenomenon of the fentanyl crisis is in many cities, there's been populations of people who've used heroin for decades. And when the drug supply transitioned from predominantly heroin to predominantly fentanyl, there was a really big spike in overdose death rates among these people who, although they likely had a cascade of problems that resulted in them, regularly using drugs for long periods of time. They were, living. But when the drug supply transitioned, it unfortunately, poisoned a lot of people. And so, we really have to be mindful of the fact that the drug supply is not safe. It's unpredictable. And, to the extent that you have access to resources that can help you monitor it and mitigate that risk, you should absolutely take advantage of those. You know, from that perspective, I also think, you know, a lot of the sort of basic insight, I doubt, you know, that deprim, reprim, you know, this is not causing big changes in overdose death rates. I don't think that's a huge surprise to people who use drugs, but I'm not sure. I would just say that's the overall finding from my perspective, is that, you know, this policy change is not the first order thing explaining variation in overdose death rates.
I've been speaking with Michael Zurab, PhD, a data scientist in New York City and lead author of an article published September 5th in the journal JAMA Network Open entitled Drug Decriminalization, Fentanyl and Fatal Overdoses in Oregon. Reporting for KABU News, I'm Doug McGee.
It's Greg McVicker, creator of Undercurrents. Glad you're listening. This is KBOO 90.7, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio's annual meeting